This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Luc Olivier Dumablet.
And I'm Yannick Magnan.
And what's our topic for this week, Yannick?
The Old Computer Challenge for 2023.
Ooh, but before you start, we have some follow-up. And I'll start this follow-up session with our small hiatus note that we will be taking a summer hiatus. And it will begin after the release of episode 211, which is literally the next episode, and that's on July 30th. And we will resume with the release of episode 212 on September 10th. So we will be enjoying a nice month off during August. But be sure to stay tuned. We will be back in September.
Yeah.
For my item of follow-up, in previous episodes, and especially in the last episode, I talked about CarPlay, but in previous episode, I talked about CarPlay generally. And I was always curious to see what car makers could do with automakers' CarPlay apps, as we've discussed in a great length in previous episodes. And I randomly come into a car, I don't really remember how that happened, I would assume social network, but I came across an update to the My Porsche app, and it seems to be related with the release of the 2024 Porsche Cayenne SUV. And it is about the update where inside the My Porsche app, when running CarPlay, you can now modify a lot more functionality of the car, like the HVAC system, like the lighting inside the car, things that you would be forced to quit the CarPlay experience and go back into the native infotainment system of Porsche, now can be customized inside CarPlay itself. So the idea is, and don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure that the 2024 Porsche Cayenne can use wireless CarPlay, but even if it is wired, the second you're in the CarPlay world, you can stay in the CarPlay world and change a lot of your car settings in there. So I have, again, from one blog post and a couple of marketing photos from Porsche, it's hard to really decipher if it is really a CarPlay automaker's app type, but it was one of the rare ones I've seen done that, so I would assume yes. So I'll have a link in the show notes so you can go look at those marketing photos and see the possibility. And there's a note, I found that on carbuzz.com, and they were saying that this is currently on the Porsche Cayenne, like I mentioned, but that they expect that other cars using the same PCM, so Porsche Communication Manager, will get this update too, but they didn't mention any timelines for this. And that's it for my follow-up. What about you, Yannick?
People who have listened to the podcast for, let's say, the last 3 years know that I have been on the hunt for a new camera, and mm-hmm. I have kept describing this mythical camera that I wanted Sony to release for a very long time now, and it's finally here. It's the Alpha 6700. It was announced this week. And I'm very excited for this camera. The rumors had it at a more expensive price than what actually ended up being announced. So I think the rumors said that it was going to be $2,000 for just the body, which was kind of a yikes price for an APS-C camera. To be honest, this price is going to be yikes for a lot of people as well. But it is within what I was expecting the camera to cost, which is good. So it's going to be $1,900 Canadian. I believe that's $1,400 US. Is that correct?
Yes, yeah. You're correct.
And this is an APS-C camera with basically the new image processor, the new sensor, all the great goodness that was in the FX30, which was a camera, cinema camera that Sony released not too long ago, except sort of targeted towards hybrid shooters, so people who do both photography and video. I am super interested in this camera. I have looked at my finances, and I'm pretty sure I can actually get this in the next few months and not break the bank. So I'm very excited to be picking this up in the near future. I will have to check if where I can pre-order here in Canada and like when that's coming out and all of that stuff. But yeah, very excited for this camera to finally have the camera I've always dreamed of coming out, finally coming out 4 years later than I thought it was going to come out.
Which is interesting. I think for your first question, I've received an email from the newsletter at Gustline, so I think you could just pre-order there. It seems to me, at least in the US, that the pre-order was on July 13th, so the day after the announcement on July 12th. Also, we're recording a bit late this week, so we're on Saturday the 15th, and I think I should include this in the show notes too. There's pretty much a good battle of APS-C camera, hybrid cameras happening right now with the release of the Fuji XS20 that was released, I think, 2 months ago. And now with this, I know the Petapixel YouTube channel is planning to have really like kind of a showdown or just a comparison between this camera, the Fuji, and then Canon R7, if I recall correctly. I guess I would assume closer to the release date of the Sony A6700, and that is supposed to be in August if you pre-order that launch date, so I wouldn't be surprised early August or worst case scenario early September the first few examples will get released. So I'm pretty eager to see when you'll do your pre-order and then see it in person too.
Yeah, the important thing is that I get it before February, because that is when I intend to return to Japan, and I want to shoot a lot of pretty photos. So that's pretty much it for my follow-up. Excited about it. I guess if I buy one in the near future, we might talk about it on the show.
Oh, we will talk about it in the show. I guess that might happen maybe after the hiatus at this point with the release date and things like that. But still, for sure, if you get one, you're required to talk about it on the show.
Yeah, definitely. I think we can go into the main topic now.
Mm-hmm.
I've been participating in a little challenge for the last week, or at least it's not technically completed at the moment of recording. We're recording on Saturday, as we mentioned, and this challenge technically ends tomorrow night. But this challenge is the old computer challenge. So 3 years ago, is that true? 2 years
ago. You're asking me?
It's the third challenge.
Oh, okay.
So 2 years ago, Solène Rapin, who is a really interesting blogger in the BSD and immutable Linux distribution world, posted this challenge for the first time.
Oh.
And the old computer challenge, the original one, was basically grab an old computer, use it as your main daily driver computer for a week, report on the internet or on Gopher or on Gemini, how you dealt with that. And then the year after, the challenge was different. The challenge was you can only use the internet for 1 hour cumulative per day, which forced a lot of people to rework how they compute so that they can work mostly offline. That is something I semi used to because of my bad internet, but it's still a big change. My internet at least works for most of the day. It just drops out every once in a while. And then this year's challenge was basically a redo of the first year's challenge, except the conditions were changed to allow people with higher power computers to basically simulate what it's like to use an older computer by using various OS flags. Now, obviously, like, this challenge was intended for people who use Unix and Linux, so it's a lot easier to do things like disable all your CPU cores and force a limit of 512 megabytes of RAM and run at your lowest CPU frequency when you're on Linux or BSD. Not necessarily easy to do in OS X or Windows. But yeah, that was basically the goal. So you could either use an old computer that sort of fit into those conditions, or you could use a modern computer and then limit yourself to one core, one thread, use 512 megabytes of RAM max, and use a CPU scheduler that would force your processor to run at its lowest clock speed. Recently, I've been interested in older Linux distributions for no particular reason. I'm just feeling nostalgic for like that era of desktop Linux. And I've been wanting to get like an older computer I could run those distributions on from like when we were in college or around that time. So obviously, like, netbook hardware kind of falls square into that time frame. I had a Dell Mini 9, which I forgot that my brother still has. I found out after I bought the PC that that I still had it back home.
That would have been a cheaper way to participate.
Yeah, although I'm not really sad that I got this. So I just said it. I got an EPC 701, which is essentially one of the first machines to kick off the netbook boom of the mid-2000s. It was released in the year 2007. It has a 900 megahertz 32-bit Celeron, which I didn't realize that the original EPCs didn't ship with Atom processors. I thought they were sort of the launch product for Atom processors, but they were not. They launched with Celerons, and then Atom came afterwards. It also has 512 megabytes of RAM and a tiny 4 gigabyte SSD, which turned out to be a little bit of a problem for a bunch of potential OSs I wanted to run. So I picked this up for about $80 Canadian last month, which is an incredible steal because it was in great physical condition, and the battery is remarkable for the age of this device, which is 16 years. So I'm very happy with how that turned out as a purchase, and I really like this little machine. It also has a crazy amount of I/O, which I did not realize. It's like shocking for a netbook. It has three USB ports. They are USB 2.0, obviously. It has an SD card slot, Ethernet, 56K modem, VGA, and two 3.5 millimeter jacks for mic and headphone. That's kind of nuts.
Yeah.
That's more than the Macs at the time had.
If I recall correctly, I forgot which Acer netbook I had.
The Aspire one.
I think you're correct.
I mean, I think technically that's the line name. It's right. Not like the SKU, but...
No, for sure. I forgot to dig out photos to see if I had. I remember at some point I replaced its shitty SSD, which I think was like maybe 10 gig or even maybe 8 gig, something small like you mentioned, with the hard drive from an iPod to at least get more storage. And that was a fun moment. But this one, if I recall correctly, had an Ethernet port, and it was like huge on its side because it was more or less the thickness of the netbook.
Exactly. Yeah, and I remember with my Dell Mini 9 that I was using Arch Linux on it at the time, and I'm pretty sure... multiple times you were with me when I was reinstalling Arch Linux between classes because I yes. like my Ricer FS file system died or something. That's the hardware I used for this. It was really cool. It came pre-installed with a weird stripped down Windows XP installed. Like, it had Notepad and I think two other apps and nothing else. Like, even the pre-installed Windows stuff. And it had the Wi-Fi driver, and that's about it. I think there was no browser installed. Like, I'm not sure exactly what I was supposed to do with that Windows XP install, so I quickly put it in the trash, which brings up the question of, okay, but what OS are you going to put on this thing? And that, as I mentioned, turned out to be slightly more complex than I had thought. So originally, I was going to try a distribution called Antix Linux. It's one of the more... actively maintained Linux distributions that actively targets older devices, right? So they still have a 32-bit distribution, which a lot of Linux distributions have just abandoned 32-bit altogether. And Antix is really built using, I would say, 15 to 20-year-old window managers and desktop environments. So you can use like IceWM or FVWM. What's the other one? I think technically it was either Fluxbox or Blackbox. So not even OpenBox, which became more trendy afterwards. It's like one of the OG box type window managers was available. Like those were your three options. And it was a really cool distribution. It ran pretty well as a live USB image. But I wanted to install it to the 4 gigabyte SSD. And that's where I sort of ran into my first big problem is that even though the live USB image was less than 4 gigabytes, that was compressed. So it meant that when I tried to install it to the SSD, it would just fail like 95% into the install with no error message that means anything. It would just flat out die in the middle of the thing. And it took me quite a while to actually figure out what was happening. And then I was like, oh, okay, it's trying to install more than 4 gigabytes of stuff on the 4 gigabyte SSD. And there's a swap partition too. So, not the greatest idea. Luckily, like Antix has other like lighter weight versions of the operating system, but I couldn't get them to boot on the EPC, which was kind of a problem. So I had to look at other options. Before I go into the distribution that I actually went with, I do want to mention, like, I did consider using BSDs because I've been curious about BSD for a really long time, but I've never really used it for anything substantial. So I do eventually want to check that out. I also considered Haiku because I am a big BOS fan, and I have heard really good things about recent versions of Haiku and that they're possibly even usable as daily driver operating systems, which is kind of shocking to me, knowing how long it took for it to get there. But ultimately, I wanted to stick to Linux because at least I knew how Linux worked, so I knew that I would have some confidence that I could actually make it through this challenge, whereas learning a completely new OS in the process is maybe too much to handle all at once. And that's when I tried to look for more aggressively minimalist Linux distributions, and that is when I discovered Slita's Linux. Have you ever heard of Slita's Linux before?
Why are you asking this question? You know the answer, and of course it's no. Come on.
Okay, so Slita's stands for Simple, Light, Incredible, Temporary Autonomous Zone, which is kind of a bonkers name for a Linux distribution.
Whoa, wait, Temporary Autonomous Zone?
Apparently that's like a reference to some science fiction novel that I never read or something.
Oh, okay, okay. It's not something technical about a distro.
I think technically it's meant to refer to the fact that you can use it as a live USB image.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
It's a really nerdy way to say you've got a live USB image.
Yes.
I think Slita's is generally used for like security research type projects, but it ultimately doesn't really matter much to my use case. I just want something that runs. What's really important about this distribution, though, is that it was guaranteed to fit on a 4GB SSD, and I can confirm this because the full-size Slita's live USB image is 50 megabytes, which is fucking insane because you get a ton of software on that image. I don't know how they fit a ton of software on that image, but it's there. And it has extremely lean system requirements as well. And the entire experience of running this distribution is kind of a blast of the past. Like, it's technically an actively maintained distribution. It's a rolling release. And it has been since 2017, which means you basically just get new updates every couple weeks or so for various packages. Now, of course, a lot of the software that is being distributed as part of this distribution for old devices has a lot of unmaintained software, right? So you're not going to be seeing a ton of updates for like shit that shipped with GNOME 2 because no one is using GNOME 2 anymore. LXDE, which is like the desktop environment that this distribution uses, hasn't actually been maintained in like, what, like 5, maybe 10 years? So there's a lot of retro components to this distribution. That means you're not going to be seeing updates for a ton of software, but the important thing is the updates that you do get, because this is a Linux distribution that feels incredibly retro, but also keeps pace with what it needs to stay relevant in today's world. And that means you can use modern TLS and all of that stuff and access regular websites from this distribution just fine. It feels a lot like what running Linux on a netbook was like 16 years ago. It's just everything that you would expect to be broken because you're using a 16-year-old OS is still working, which is a really cool thing, actually.
Yeah, that sounds cool indeed.
One of the things that was part of the original challenge rules, again, was that you should tweak the governor, which is like the CPU scheduler or whatever, so the CPU runs at the lowest clock. And one of the weird quirks of using an antiquated Linux distribution like this is that it has a terribly old kernel version. It uses 3.16.55, which I think that was probably around what was running on my laptop 15 years ago. Like, it's not a new kernel by any stretch of the imagination. And because of that, all of the instructions I can find on the internet to tell me how to limit the governor so that it runs at the slowest clock do not work, because CPU freq, the stuff I'm looking for, just doesn't exist in the file system. And I'm like, oh, okay. I did manage to actually find like a way to monitor what the current clock speed of the processor is, and it's spending most of its time running at 650 megahertz, which I think is good enough. If I'm using a 650 megahertz Celeron in 2023, I don't think anyone's going to say, oh, you're cheating for the challenge.
Yeah, and its max clock is what, 750, 700?
900.
900. Oh, okay, yeah.
It's like 2/3 of the max performance, which is...
Yeah.
It's pretty good. And consider that the battery runs for about 2.5 hours when it's running like this on this distribution. And that's like watching video the whole time. That's pretty good for a laptop of this age. It was pretty cool. Now, obviously, one of the first things you're going to want to do with one of these computers is get online. Luckily for me, it's funny because I had more trouble with Arch Linux getting my Wi-Fi working like 15 years ago than I did with this. It was just automatically detected by the Linux distribution. Didn't have to do any module shenanigans or whatever.
Nice.
It just worked out of the box, and it worked out of the box with most Linux distributions I tried on it, which is really good. The next question is, okay, but what browser do you use, right? On Antix, they had they had one wildcard option and they had one realistic option. So Antix, when I was trying that distribution out, shipped with Firefox. It was still an older version of Firefox. It was like the ESR version, which is their extended support release. So kind of like an LTS version of Firefox. The problem is Firefox hasn't been available for 32-bit in a really long time. So there was also that going on. So I think it was like Firefox 70, which was like the last 32-bit ESR version of Firefox or something to that extent. And then the wildcard browser was Dillo, which I had forgotten about. Dillo is a really, really old browser that supports a lot of HTML5-ish stuff, but it doesn't support JavaScript and it barely supports CSS.
wow.
So it's really only useful for reading documents on the internet, which ultimately, like, if we're being honest, that's mostly what this laptop can do anyway. So it's not a terrible choice, but it was interesting and it was nice to be reminded that Dillo still existed. I don't even know what UI framework it uses. It looks awful. It's absolutely hideous, but it does a job pretty well if you want something that's really, really fast and efficient, which I appreciate. What I did end up going with was Midori, which came pre-installed with Citas. So Midori at one point was the GNOME WebKit browser. Since then, it has been replaced a few times. I think now technically GNOME Web is the new name for Epiphany, which was the replacement for Midori when GTK3 became the UI framework. Midori is entirely written in GTK2 because pretty much all the software in this distribution is GTK2. Because it's meant for low-spec hardware, and GTK2 runs pretty well on old hardware. Midori can do shockingly well on the modern internet, as long as you're not trying to run web applications written in JavaScript, which unfortunately is a lot of things these days. But if you're just reading content on the internet, it is very good, and things do not look terrible, which is important. Then there's like the alt web that I read. So everything on Gemini or on Gopher, which coincidentally, a lot of people as part of this challenge were also publishing their own thoughts and experiences about this challenge on Gopher and on Gemini. So it was especially relevant over the last week to actually be using one of those browsers. I've been using Bombadillo, which is a command line browser for all of these things. Anyway, all of these protocols only deal with text anyway, so you're not really missing out on much by using a command line client instead of a GUI one. It's mostly just formatting and fonts and stuff. But yeah, really great experience with Bombadillo as well, and Bombadillo would have run on much, much lower spec machines as well. In Midori, there were a couple of things that I wanted to do to just like make it the experience more enjoyable and usable online. So Midori has customizable search engines, which is something that honestly all web browsers should have. Like, it really bugs me that Safari has like the three hard-coded search engines of like Google, Bing, and DuckDuckGo. I wish I could just put in my own URL in there, but I guess they get paid enough money that by those search engines that they're not going to do that, but that sucks.
I thought there was a fourth one now.
Ecosia, I think. Yeah. Using Midori's custom search engine settings, I was able to configure DuckDuckGo Lite, which is basically DuckDuckGo with no JavaScript, no or very minimal CSS. Like, I think there's very little styling in that page anyway, and it just loads incredibly fast, which is very important. I want, if I'm going to be browsing the internet on this thing, I want the bulk of my loading times to be concentrated on the page I'm actually trying to load and not the search results page, and this is perfect for that. Next up is social media. So we're kind of in a funny time in social media, right? Because previously I could have just used like ancient Twitter clients that were written for GTK 2 15 years ago when we were still using Twitter. We're not using Twitter anymore. So had to
No
sort of,
would they work, right? Because it would be third-party clients. So.
Yeah, they wouldn't work anyway, but still. And like m.twitter.com has been like, they shut down the dumb phone version of m.twitter.com a long, long time ago. So that's not even viable, right? So one of the Mastodon clients that exists out there is called BrutalDon. And it's particularly notable because it runs entirely with no JavaScript, or at least no JavaScript is required to actually use it adequately. It's just HTML forms that you submit with an HTTP post request like in the good old days. So you can use that on this, and they have a completely unstyled theme you can use that basically just makes everything black and white tables like in the good old days, which runs incredibly well on this machine because it's essentially just a really old website. So Mastodon and the Fediverse and all of that stuff is completely accessible to this hardware, as is through BrutalDon, which is great. The hardest part is logging in because oftentimes you're going to be redirected to the full fat Mastodon instance, and then getting that to work within your browser is going to be challenging, even though it's just a login form. But once you've gotten past the login wall, it works great. Co-host, which is the other social networking site that I use quite a bit these days to read a bunch of stuff from cool people, that is completely unusable in Midori. It's a React app, so I'm not entirely surprised. The login form doesn't even load correctly. The entire website is a catastrophe on Midori. It's unusable, so I pretty much just stayed off of it this week. The last thing I want to talk about in the going online section is publishing to my website. I have always had a very extremely lightweight way of publishing things to my website. I basically have a folder of markdown files, and I have a shell script that compares the modification date of the markdown files to a hidden file in the same directory that I update the modification date of every time I rebuild the thing. So it just rebuilds the pages that have been updated since the last publish. And then I take whatever the output list in the console is of the files that were regenerated, and I upload those manually to my website. So all of that just works on the new system, because essentially all I have to do is make sure that markdown.perl is somewhere on the system, and it just works. So I have been seamlessly publishing to my website on the thing. All I had to do was copy my source files from my Mac to the EPC, and I can just use the same shell script. And I think technically the only thing I had to change was, instead of using bash explicitly, I had to change it to sh, because this machine doesn't have bash on it. But like, that's it. So yeah, it was really easy to publish to my website, and that's how I've been posting updates about the old computer challenge throughout the week directly from the EPC without issues. However, speaking of issues, there were some roadblocks to this challenge. And one of them is, of course, recording this podcast right now. Very hard to do VoIP on an EPC, and finding a client that would run on both a 32-bit Intel machine with 900 megahertz of horsepower versus something that would run on Ducati Vie's M1 Mac. Kind of a disconnect there.
In my defense, I'm not even running on, I'm recording on an Apple Silicon device.
Oh, well, sure. But anyway, you get the point. It's right. The machines would still be like 15 years apart.
Don't forget, I'm recording on the old laptop. I think there's maybe 5 years difference between the EPC and the laptop I'm currently using just for recording purposes, because it's the 2012 Retina MacBook Pro.
Oh, okay. But still, so, basically, modern VoIP is not going to run on the EPC. That's what I'm trying to say. So we'll get back to how the podcast ties into this challenge a little bit later.
Yeah, and if you maybe allow me an interruption, I don't think you mentioned it, but that doesn't include work, right?
Right. As part of the challenge, Solen's blog post always says, hey, we don't want you to get fired for doing this challenge. Use your normal stuff during your work day. But once you get off work, just use your old computer stuff. And of course, like there's always a thing like the challenge is not about stopping you from doing things. It is about getting you to think outside the box and sort of look at old computers and how your life can fit into them or not and all of that stuff. And I think that's the important part of the challenge. And if you run into something that's really prohibitive, you can still go ahead and do it on another computer. But it's still important. Well, not important, but it's interesting to document that and see right. what the pain points are.
Yeah, you didn't stop using your phone too either. Or you just tried to minimize using it as much as you could.
Yeah, that's interesting that you mentioned that. So I'm not going to lie. Like, I barely use my Mac during the week anyway, most of the time. In a strange thing, like the PC I use for gaming is probably the computer that I use the most during the week, just because I would rather play games than work on other stuff. But most of the computing I was substituting here was iPad usage, right? So I completely stopped using my iPad Pro this week. So that's mostly what I was substituting as part of this challenge. Anything that I would normally do on my phone, I continued to do on my phone because it's technically not part of the challenge.
Right, right.
But I wasn't taking things that I was doing on the iPad and doing it on my phone. Instead, I was actively trying to do them on the EPC. So going back to the roadblocks, one of the things I do every Monday night is I hold a fighting game tournament for a bunch of friends. And this turned out to be a bit of an issue. I mean, I knew it was going to be an issue, but I didn't realize to what degree it would be an issue. So there are like three issues with this. So the first thing is Discord. Discord, of course, is a horrible web application that is a pain in the ass to use. Luckily, there are third-party clients for Discord that are not technically using any kind of public API, so use them at your own risk. But the one I like to use is called Ripcord, which is a Qt application. So naturally, your brain goes, oh, maybe you can run that on Linux, right? No. So Ripcord is not open source, first of all. It is only available as a binary on the author's website. And it is a 64-bit app image, which means it will not run on the EPC at all.
Oh, that sucks.
There's also, like, the Macintosh Garden people who use RetroMax have put together an IRC gateway for Discord. The problem is you have to hand over, essentially, your API key to someone's random machine who is running this IRC gateway. And that's not something I'm interested in doing at this time. Unless I host my own instance or something like that, I'm not particularly interested in that. So I just opted to use Discord on my phone instead. We host the bracket for this fighting game tournament on Challenge, which is a bracket hosting website. This website actually completely crashes Midori when you try going to it. Like the normal client facing pages, like or the landing page or whatever, like that will run fine. But if you actually try to go to a tournament page, it crashes the browser, which is not great. So I had to do that on my phone as well. And then the games that we play are played through Fightcade, which is an Electron-based wrapper, which facilitates matchmaking with various emulators that support NutPlay. And on Mac, there is a Mac and a Linux version of this, but it runs everything in Wine. And I don't think the Electron-based wrapper is available for 32-bit either. So there's no real way to run Fightcade on the EPC without essentially asking people to trade IP addresses back and forth, which is a lot less convenient than just right-clicking someone's name and clicking challenge. And I wasn't going to force everyone in this tournament to just like send IP addresses and port forward back and forth. So I just did it the good old way. So basically, like, this ran pretty much as I usually do it on the gaming PC, and I just used Discord and Challenge on my phone instead. And I wasn't really able to make that fit into my usual setup. Another potential roadblock that we could have gotten was we do a Wednesday night TV night on the same Discord server. And that is where we watch a bunch of YouTube videos and anime through a website called SciTube, which requires a janky Google Chrome extension to actually allow you to watch random videos off of someone's Google Drive. And Chrome is not available for 32-bit. Even if it did, it would run like shit. And even if it did, not going to be watching a 1080p video on the EPC at full speed. So,
and just Chrome would require at least a gig of install from your SSD.
Yep. Yep. Fun. I love this Google Chrome world we live in.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Luckily, like, I was traveling this week, so I did not have to, I never have to do anything, but I wasn't going to participate in TV night anyway, and I sort of did my own alternative TV night, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But before that, I want to talk about other shit I did on the EPC to entertain myself throughout the week. And one of those things was experimenting with GTK2 development and a little app I made. Well, it doesn't really do anything yet, but it's a little proof of concept GTK2 experiment that I did called Loxodon, which is a Mastodon client for GTK2.
Nice.
Yeah. So one of the first things that I did when I installed Slitas is they have a web front end to the package manager where you can browse all of the available packages. And I started looking through all of the programming languages, and I was wondering, like, okay, which ones of these have GTK2 libraries that I can use to code GUI applications? And I tried a bunch of them, and a lot of them had weird broken dependencies and stuff that would just like crash whenever you tried to run a GTK2 application with them. But the one that worked the best was Perl 5 and the GTK2 Perl wrapper. So I ended up using that. I haven't written Perl in 15 years, so it was really far back for me, but it was really fun to get back into it. And I basically like mapped out, here's what I need to do to have a basic timeline view, and I started creating all of the UI components for that. And there is a screenshot on my website where you can see it. It's not particularly ugly. It is particularly ugly. I messed that up. And there are weird visual bugs. Like, for example, my avatar, instead of sizing down the full image of the avatar, it just shows a chunk of the avatar in the size that I wanted, and I can't find out how to actually make it scale properly yet, so it looks really weird. It's really fun to mess around with a new GUI framework and poking around with like this retro environment. And that's when I realized that it's actually pretty creatively freeing to be working on an obsolete platform. As Apple developers, we sort of know that there's this unwritten rule that, hey, if Apple announces a new technology, you probably should adopt it, because that probably means that the thing it's replacing is going to go away soon. See also Swift UI and all that stuff.
Yeah, I know you would use this example. Soon could be put in scare quotes for now.
It depends on how core it is to the iOS experience, right? I don't think they're going to delete UIKit next year, but they have been aggressive to that degree for less used frameworks, let's say, or more niche frameworks. So there's always this software treadmill that you're working on that I complained about in the last episode. And I think that's particularly draining if you're not invested in the same future of the developer platforms as Apple is, for example. Here, I'm working with a platform that effectively has not seen any change in like 15 to 20 years. GTK 3 was already out when I had my Dell Mini 9 and when I was using that as a daily driver. And now we're on like GTK 4. And we're very far away from the GTK 2 world. So effectively, like when I look up documentation for GTK 2, I'm looking at like the legacy archive section of the GNOME website, right? It's like not actively maintained at all.
It still lies. It's still up though.
Yeah. It's great that they're keeping it up there, and it looks exactly the same. It uses the same style sheet as it used back in the day, so it runs great on the Midori browser.
Nice.
And it's just cool that I have like this fixed platform where I don't have to worry that next week I'm going to wake up and I'm going to be told, hey, now's the time to replace this entire subsection of your code because we decided that we were going to replace it with a cooler framework that's more trendy. you can't be derailed by a platform holder's decisions if the platform holder has effectively abandoned the platform that they were developing on, right? So I think it's a lot of fun to have that. And it reminds me a lot of the old days of when I was programming, where I had a problem I wanted to solve and I didn't feel like there was any kind of pressure from any kind of platform vendor or whatever to lock into a given technology. I can just experiment with whatever technology and language I want, and I can do stuff with that and not feel like I'm at risk for doing that. And it has felt like a really long time since I've been able to do that in software. And I think it was really refreshing for me to have that experience this week. Now that I've said positive things about this experience, I'm going to say more negative things about the GTK2 interface framework, because wow, it's a lot of fun to play with, but it's also kind of a giant pile of shit.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah. And I can't tell if I am just awful at using this framework and I can't figure it out, or if it's really true that GTK2 just gives you so little control over anything visually. Like, sizing your objects properly is a pain in the ass. Positioning them, like, you can say, oh, the size of the element is meant to be like X pixels by Y pixels. And you can say the XY coordinate of the top left is here, right? So you can position its rect pretty much anywhere. But the problem is, like, if you're using text elements, there's like no way to, or at least I can't tell if there's a way to say, hey, I want a text element that measures this and I want it to wrap. Like, you're sort of on your own to figure out like how to do that. It's weird. It's confusing. I have to do a lot more research to do so that this Mastodon timeline looks presentable. And I think once I have it presentable, I just have to hook it up to the API and that'll be nice. And then maybe I can actually have like a usable Mastodon client that isn't running through a web page, which is my goal in all of this. I really don't like using web apps, and I wish I could use a native application to do that. And this is the closest it's ever gotten for a GTK2 Mastodon client. But yeah, I think I have enough fun messing around with this little side project thing, and it's different enough from what I do at work that I think I'm going to continue to work on it after this challenge is over. And also, I just think this machine is really fun to use, and I don't think I'm going to stop using it after the challenge is over. Next activity on the list, we're going to go back to the TV night thing. Before the challenge began, I sort of experimented with a bunch of video codecs and Handbrake, and I was trying to find, like, what is the best balance of file size, quality, and usability on the EPC for videos that I would transcode on my Mac beforehand. And I found out that if I use a 240p video target resolution and I set everything up to 2.5 megabit bitrate in MPEG-4, it looks great and it's reasonably sized. And the main reason I couldn't make things bigger than 240p is because GNOME MPlayer is kind of also a weird piece of shit, thanks to GTK2. Where, for example, like if I do full screen or whatever, it like flickers where the size of the window grows to fill the screen. And like there's a snapshot of where the video was previously that gets frozen in the corner of the window and it doesn't go away. So it's kind of like when you were like dragging windows in Windows and like the trail of the window was sticking with it, right? I'm having trouble describing this, but like basically there are weird visual artifacts all over the place if you try to resize it with the window in this client. And because of that, it was basically unusable unless I used videos that were 240p and windowed. So I didn't even use full screen. So yeah. I had to watch all my TV night videos in a 240p window, but hey, it was fun enough. The content was still good, so I did that. And yeah, if you're ever interested in transcoding videos so that they're viewable on the EPC, 240p, 2.5 megabit, MPEG-4 is pretty much what you're going to be looking out for. So that was during my Montreal trip on Wednesday, and another thing I did on my Montreal trip on Wednesday was importing photos for my Canon IXUS cameras via the built-in SD card slot. So the SD card slot does work in Linux, which is great. And I don't think I've ever owned a laptop that had a built-in SD card slot. So I didn't know what a luxury it was to have that. but I'm pretty sure it's faster for me to import photos from my Canon Ixus cameras on this machine than it is on any other machine I have. Just because it has an SD card slot and I can just go boop on the camera and then take that card and put it directly into the thing and it just opens up in my file browser and I don't have to do anything. On the Mac, I have to find my stupid USB-C dongle. On the PC, same thing. Actually, on the PC, I only have the USB-C dongle, so I have to unplug the power from my ThinkPad if I'm using my work PC and use that single USB-C port to import my SD stuff, which was kind of a pain when I was doing a bunch of like Raspberry Pi SD card stuff recently. SD card slots. Turns out they're pretty good in laptops. Maybe more laptops should have them.
Hey, I feel you. One of the first rare things I bought after getting the M1 iMac was color matching. I'll call it a dock, but it's more or less clipped to the bottom of the screen. Mm-hmm. And I bought it mainly, to get USB-A ports, but mainly to get an SD card slot. And let me tell you, in the past 24 hours, I think put 5 memory card in it. For sure, just like swapping cards. I've been doing a lot of photo management, but I digress. But yeah, I agree with that statement. An SD card slot is amazing.
Yeah, definitely. So let's move on and talk about some other upcoming stuff I want to do in the next 2 days of the challenge. So first off is gaming. One of the things I did not realize until after I installed DOSBox is that, first of all, the resolution of the EPC's display is 800 by 480. That is tiny by modern standards, but it's also really great for playing DOSBox games because generally DOS games would max out at 640 by 480, which means you can use it with black bars on the left and right side of your screen, and it just fills the screen at native resolution, which is great. So I've been meaning to check out A-Train, which is a train business simulator game, kind nice. Of like SimCity, but specialized on train businesses. So I think I'm going to be playing that tonight on the laptop, and hopefully it runs well. I know that it runs because I verified that it does, but it seems like a really great little machine to be running old retro PC games through DOSBox. And then, of course, the other thing I am going to be trying probably tomorrow is, can I edit the podcast on this thing?
Ooh,
yeah, because like Audacity, for all of the drama that it has had in the recent years due to the telemetry stuff that happened I think it was last year.
I didn't know about that. They added telemetry to Audacity?
They tried to anyway, but the user base completely complained and made a huge fit about it. And then we realized like, oh, okay, the people who own Audacity now are also not great people. Like it's not just a problem of are you adding telemetry or not, but it's also like, how are you reacting to people, reacting negatively to it? And their response was not great either. So Audacity, I think they're still making Mac OS 9 versions. So I think there's a pretty good chance it might work. The place where it might fall down is noise reduction performance. Like if it takes a minute on my Mac to actually run the noise reduction on the audio file, I don't even want to know what it's going to take on the EPC. So I might just offset that to the Mac and then do the rest of the editing through that. The other thing that kind of worries me, though, is the size of the WAV files that we generally get as part of this. I think it's going to take up like 2 gigs just to have the audio files. So it might just crash mid-edit, which is also kind of scary. But hey, I'll give it a shot. I might actually put it on the USB drive, but then you're dealing with USB bandwidth issues. So who knows? If it ends up taking too long, I'm just going to switch over to the iPad and finish it there because I don't want to spend the rest of the weekend editing the podcast on this old machine.
Yeah, please don't. We're recording late because of me, so I don't want to put you too much strain on you for that because you want to put it on those slow computers.
So that's pretty much the upcoming activities I had planned for this machine for the rest of the weekend. I'm due to a bunch of other factors, like I haven't had as much time to actually use the computer throughout the week than I would have liked, mostly because I was traveling and dodging tornadoes and shit.
Yep.
But and there was a work party yesterday, so I was gone all night. But yeah, I've enjoyed this challenge quite a bit so far, and I do have some takeaways to share with the podcast before we leave. So the first takeaway should not be surprising to people who listen to this podcast semi-regularly, which is the modern web is a mistake. The web is meant for documents, not for applications. And I think this applies as much for actual web applications that run inside a browser than it does for Electron applications that run in an Electron wrapper. And that's sort of the second takeaway as well, is like, I think there's a big myth of software efficiency where we get so much higher power computers that you can afford to be less efficient. And we constantly do less efficient things in the name of providing more value to the people who pay money for software, which is like, we want to write things once and run them everywhere, which is why we mostly tend to gravitate towards stuff like Electron, React Native, and all of these other multi-platform frameworks, which result in less efficient, less polished applications. And they often sort of block off older computers entirely because they are less efficient, and therefore you have higher requirements for software that doesn't behave as nicely as the older versions of software, and that often don't do as much as the old versions of software. So I think if we tried to be efficient and we wrote modern software that could realistically run on much older computers, those older computers could continue to be relevant for a lot of modern use cases. And I think like seeing the Gemini browsers come back, a lot of them are terminal-based, obviously, so they're more viable to begin with. But I think seeing a lot of those browsers bring older machines back to life with what they can do is really interesting. And I think we should see more of that. And I obviously don't expect it from the commercial software world, because if you want to get paid, you generally have to go where the money is, and the money is in the new devices. So I understand the chasing game, but in the open source community, there's a lot less incentive to do that. And the last takeaway is, I think that it's a really interesting idea to adapt your personal technology choices so that the systems you rely on are simple, efficient, and easily portable to lower spec platforms. And this is something I have been trying to do for the last few years, is I've tried to be more conscious and looking at like protocols and saying, okay, how efficient is this protocol, and can it be implemented in sort of offline environments because of my internet situation, or lower power computers and all of that stuff. And that's why when I look at ActivityPub, like, I'm happy that ActivityPub is winning, in air quotes, the decentralized social network battle, because someone needs to. But at the same time, I look at that protocol and I see just massive inefficiency in how that was designed compared to something much, much more simple. Like how micro.blog worked. Now, nobody talks about micro.blog anymore. It's still around, and it still is more efficient. It still has all the same issues I complained about at the time as well. But at a protocol level, I think it is much more efficient and a lot saner of a design than ActivityPub is.
Aren't they working on ActivityPub support too?
Yeah, so it's been out for like 2 years. It's just nobody uses micro.blog, so you haven't heard about it. But you can connect your micro.blog account to ActivityPub and vice versa. So you can follow people who are there. Micro.blog is exposed as a ActivityPub server, and I believe you can follow people who have ActivityPub presences as well. But yeah, it doesn't change the core protocol. I disagree with a lot of it, and I find it super inefficient. And that's why, like, I complained about it yesterday on the Fediverse, and people were saying, yeah, it's just like RSS with inboxes. And I'm like, yeah, but RSS with inboxes doesn't need like sidekick queues that are going to blow up every time some Elon does something stupid. So yeah. So those are my takeaways. Ultimately, I had a lot of fun with this challenge, and like I said, I think I'm going to continue using this little machine because it's so cute and it's so much fun to use. And I think last year, I think my Canon Ixus camera was like my retro purchase of the year, where I was like, this is just like the best thing I bought all year, and I got a lot of enjoyment out of it. I think this year it's going to be the EPC that I have a hard time seeing what else I could buy this year that could bring me more joy than this little machine did over the last week. And that's it for me.
Nice. Yannick has mentioned a lot of things in this episode, so I hope or I expect you'll be able to find some links in the show notes or all the links in the show notes for this episode at limitlesspossibility.net/210. You can also find our back catalog of episodes at limitlesspossibility.net. The show is on the Fediverse. We are at limipo_podcast at mastodon.social. That's LIMIPO_podcast. You can also find us individually on the Fediverse. I am at Luco at mastodon.social. That's LUCCO. And you can find Yannick at
Sakarina at icosahedron.website.
And we'll see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.